Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Elodie Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. James Corbett of the Corbett Report will be joining Dave Allen for the second and third segment of the program today. You're with me, Melody Cederstrom, for the first 20 minutes of the program today, and today is Friday, February 16th, 2018. Thank you once again for joining me. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. You know, it has been such an emotional roller coaster this week. And I'm sure I'm not the only one who feels that way. I'm glad it is Friday, and certainly looking forward to the weekend, although we'll be working a little bit tomorrow to get some shipping done and everything. But so if I'm feeling that way, I'm sure many of you are also having this emotional roller coaster. And so take a little time off this weekend. And gold is certainly having its own little roller coaster of a day. We had gold, a little pressure in gold today, down $5 at $1,349. You have silver down 14 cents today at $1,678. Platinum was up strong, up $5 at $1,010. Palladium was up $27 at $1,045. The USDX today was stronger, of course, 0.55 at 89.14. Crude oil continues to climb, up 0.26 at 61.60. Paper markets today, you have the Dow. It was all over the page, up, down, everywhere. And I'm looking at up 20 points. 25,220. The NASDAQ was down almost 17 points at 7,239. The S&P was up a whole point. Yep, a whole point. 2,732. 10-year yield, 2.88%. And that was actually down 0.01. And, of course, we then saw pressure on the euro with a stronger dollar, down 0.73 at 124. We're kind of getting out of that extreme fear. The number, remember earlier this week, it was an 8. Well, it moved all the way to 15. So soon we'll be back into that green territory. And again, it just shows the volatility that, you know, not only the markets are experiencing, but, you know, also this volatility feeds down, you know, into every corner of this nation. So just be safe out there, ladies and gentlemen. And it's going to be this way, I think. I don't think we're going to see calm waters any longer. I said last year going into 2017 it would be a volatile year. I said coming into 2018 it's going to be more volatile than what last year was. And I can't even imagine what next year will bring us. So I don't think this is going to weigh. I think it's pretty much the course that we're on. I can't see anything changing and taking us into calmer waters. We don't have the fundamentals in order to take us there. So we don't have the boat and the engine to take us into those calmer waters. You know, it was interesting today. We talk about tariffs. We talk about, you know, maybe some across the board tariffs on various items and so forth. We've seen it placed on the by the administration on washing machines and solar panels. Today, you had the Commerce Department's recommendation to impose heavier tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. Of course, we all know the Commerce Secretary is Wilbur Ross. And he has proposed actions. These haven't been taken, but they have been proposed, taking action against some tariffs on the steel industry. Nucor, the largest U.S. steel maker today, climbed 4%. While the U.S. Steel and AK Steel, they also soared more than 10% apiece. But anyway, Ross recommends that across-the-board tariff of 24% on imports from all countries, or tariffs of at least 53% on imports from 12 countries in particular. And of course, you know, the two top ones would be China and Russia. Commerce Secretary Ross also suggested limiting imports of steel into the United States. Aluminum stocks, of course, they bounced 8% for Century. And some of your larger aluminum makers like Alcoa, they also ticked higher. Arconic and, of course, Reliance, they all ticked higher on their numbers. And the actual aluminum prices climbed about 2% on this news. The Commerce Department recommended a tariff on 7.7% in aluminum imports from all countries, or a tariff of 26.6% on imports from 5 specific countries. The proposal also includes a proposal to cut aluminum imports for most countries. So there's a proposal. The proposal includes a proposal to cut aluminum imports from most countries by 13%. But, you know, and again, you know, I love tariffs. But, you know, sometimes you have to think things a little bit through. Are we beyond the time where tariffs can work? I don't know. Have we gone so far before? I mean, you're going to see, and this is the big argument, and you know what? Let's do it and see what happens. That's what I say. Let's do it and see what happens. You know, we can see that if the proposed tariffs and quotas lift prices on the aluminum and steel, these actions could, you know, affect the auto industry, the appliance industry. It would affect plane manufacturers and their customers. Higher prices, that means higher prices to the consumers. So higher prices at a time when consumers seem to have already been tapped out. Could this actually create a true deflationary period as consumers would wait to buy until prices drop? Although it's been a long time since the American consumer put any purchasing on hold for any length of time, I'm not so sure that would happen. But again, we look at how we are tapped out. The consumer, look at the amount of debt the consumer, we talked about it twice this week, about how much debt the consumer is holding. You know, people talk about the quarter point increases in the Fed funds. And, you know, we look to the 10-year yield because that has the most impact as those rates rise, as those yields rise. And people say, oh, what's a quarter point here? What's a quarter point there? It's no big deal. But it is a big deal when you look to the consumer, because they are tapped out on their credit. Many of them still have adjustable rates. And, you know, those little rate increases take more out of their spending, out of their disposable spending. It does make a difference. How much more deeper can they go to keep these numbers to the height that they already are? So, I mean, we are hoping that the tariffs would help the steel and aluminum makers regain market share that we have lost to the cheaper imports from China and Russia. I get that, and I hope it works. I'm not sure what the time frames would be for you to see the impacts, to see manufacturing actually pick up and see it trickle down to where it could help the you know, those that who created the manufacturers and the employees. It's far too early to know how these tariffs would shake out in the long run, but I think it's a good chance. Why not do it and to see what happens? Now, it could always create a trade war, but I think that's a chance that we should take. So again, here's something that's positive. But that doesn't always mean that we're going to have these positive things or reactions. Sometimes there are consequences to it. Cisco was another report this week that they're bringing home a bunch of money. They're going to repatriate $67 billion. This was out of date, maybe yesterday, and I'm sure it's been mentioned. I think it's important to mention it again. It's a mountain of money. And again, this is following the new tax law. Much of it's going to end up in the pockets, hopefully, of the investors. Tech company on Wednesday, $67 billion, Cisco said. The Silicon Valley firm, they make gear for computer networks. They're going to pass on a significant chunk of that cash to its shareholders over the next 2 years through share buybacks and increased dividends. So again, we said that bringing this money back, the $67 billion in foreign profits, is going to go into buybacks and increased dividends. Multinational corporations, they've previously been reluctant to move their piles of money back into the United States. Although it is kind of interesting, and we'll see how this plays through. But these new rules also mean companies can no longer avoid paying taxes on past international profits by holding the cash outside. But also, they have to pay tax whether they bring it back or not. So I think that's interesting. Moody's had estimated there was $1.4 trillion in cash offshore in November. And, of course, the five large tech companies, Microsoft, Apple, Google, Oracle, and Cisco, accounted for nearly $600 billion of that. Well, $1.4 trillion in cash offshore. You know, before this was all done, I could have sworn I've heard reports that there was anywhere from $4 to $5 trillion of cash being held offshore. Moody's estimated, this is just November, that there was $1.4 trillion. So there's a big discrepancy. So again, we really don't know how it's going to affect us, how it's going to trickle down. And but hey, I guess when we're a country in debt and bankrupt, I guess any debt is better than, I mean, tax is better than no tax at all in some of these multinational corporations. I mentioned a little bit ago that New York Federal Reserve Bank reported that U.S. household debt had been increasing for 14 consecutive months, and it reached an all-time high in the fourth quarter of 2017. Some could argue that the debt of its own might not be a problem. One of the reasons is debt will become a problem. And that, again, is, I mentioned just a few minutes ago, the interest rates are moving higher. So now all of a sudden, the Americans, the debt that they have accumulated, they could be paying much more interest on it. Their credit cards are going to cost more. Mortgage payments could get bigger. And the list goes on and on and on. American saving rate plummets 60%. Well, you know what? If everything was all great and people were going into debt and they were actually saving money to offset any bad things that came along the way, that they could, you know, really keep themselves financially efficient. But it's not when you have the American savings rate plummet by 60%. And it's impressive how little to no attention this topic gets. I mean, currently Americans are saving just 2.4% of their disposable income. For every $100 they are paid after taxes and other charges, they're saving just $2, 2.40. In early 2015, they were saving over 6%. Of their income. And if you look at it from a percentage change, they are now saving roughly 60% less than they did about 3 years ago. Going beyond this, the U.S. personal savings rate is at its lowest since 2005. And combining everything, on one hand, you have American consumers racking up massive amounts of debt and saving very little. Again, they're setting themselves up. One little hiccup in these markets, any little hiccup, higher oil prices, so many things. But hey, what could go wrong? What could go wrong? Feds are warning of cryptocurrency pump and dump schemes. The U.S. derivatives regulator warned investors yesterday about cryptocurrency pump and dump scams that aim to rip off investors by inflating the price of volatile virtual tokens through spreading bogus information. It's probably the derivatives market that's doing it. you know, they're probably bundling them up together and sending them off somewhere. But the CFTC said in a statement that it received complaints where people have lost money in these pump and dump schemes and warned against buying cryptocurrencies based on tips found on social media. As with many online frauds, this type of scam is not new. It simply deploys an emerging technology to capitalize on public interest in digital assets, the CFTC Director of Public Affairs said in a statement. I think what we're just about out of time, and I want to remind folks before we, you know, I got a couple of minutes left. We're still going to continue the Mint State 64 $20 St. Gaudens gold piece, the pre-1933s, $1,505. You receive a 1 ounce American Silver Eagle. Now, that Silver Eagle is dated 2018, so it's a beautiful, fresh, white coin. That's all we send out anyway, is beautiful, fresh, white coins when it comes to silver. It'll include your shipping costs if you purchase two or more. So it's a great, great buy. Remember, privacy, performance, and protection is what the pre-33 coins provide you. $1,500, Mint State 64, $20 gold piece. And the spread, really, you're only looking, again, what, $90 from a bullion coin? You take away the Silver Eagle, and it's the spread is even smaller. So again, folks, it's a great, great deal to be buying these $20 gold pieces at this particular time. If you have oodles of gold bullion coins and you don't have any pre-33 coins, now would be a good time to trade some of your bullion coins and get some pre-33s. Doesn't hurt to be diversified, and they offer you so many benefits in holding that coin. And really the key to purchasing the pre-33 coins is having someone like myself that can help you understand the coins and what the benefits are, how do they perform, and what can you expect through these markets. And that's what you'll learn here at Discount Gold and Silver. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. There was a lot of interesting news today. You just can't get into it in these short broadcasts. But certainly you have Mueller indicted 13 Russians, farm trolls from the elections of 2016. You can actually say, and you know, I don't know how far these indictments go. I mean, it was 2015 that I believe the Obama administration indicted five Chinese for cyber hacking and so forth, and the multinational corporations, and really nothing really comes of it. This could also show that, well, maybe Trump is cleared, but it also could show that Mueller is saying, no, we've been doing our job here, and maybe Trump isn't as innocent. I don't know. I'd like to think of it. Trump has been cleared. So 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. When we get back from the break, you will be hearing Dave Allen and James Corbett of the Corbett.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csetalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Talking away. I don't know what to say or say it anyway.
Welcome back to Discount Gold and Silver Trading Company's Financial Survival Show. This is Dave Allen, and I'll be hosting these last two segments. I'm pleased to welcome back the always informative and thought-provoking James Corbett. As listeners know, James is the founder and editor of the provocative and entertaining Corbett Report. You can view virtually all there is to know about James and his worldly viewpoints at thecorbettreport.com. That's thecorbettreport.com. James, good to have you back. How are you today?
Pretty good. Provocative and entertaining. If you throw in a thought-provoking, I'll take it.
Ah, that it is. That is, if it's any consolation, I believe that's how Melody referred to you on Wednesday's show in saying, hey, listeners, tune in to the thought-provoking James Corbett on
there it is, the trifecta. I'll take it.
Sold. Well, James, let's leave it open-ended to start today. Anything going on in your neck of the woods or elsewhere in the Far East these days that you want to share with listeners?
I guess there are a number of things. I'm sure most people are probably interested in the Korea situation and the Olympics and all of that. I don't have too much insight into that, but I do note that Gareth Porter was just writing on Truthdig he wrote an article called Can South Korea's Leader End Trump's North Korea Crisis? Basically saying that the Korean Peninsula crisis is really one that's been provoked by outside powers. And here we have Kim Jong-un sending his sister as a personal envoy to deliver a invitation for South Korean President Moon Jae-in to visit North Korea for a summit, a pretty major development, and Gareth Porter is basically saying this is really quite good news overall for lessening of tension, unless the U.S. basically tries to get in the way. And just to add, I suppose, something to that, apparently the DPRK's foreign minister actually retweeted Gareth Porter on that, basically adding some diplomatic support to that that idea. So I think that's pretty significant, and I don't think it's necessarily surprising. I think there is, I mean, certainly North and South Korea have a lot to gain by actually talking and getting involved, but it's always the question of outside meddling and how that will affect, you know, these negotiations. And unfortunately, from what I've seen of the American reporting on this so far, it's pretty nauseating. A lot of outlets are running with things like, oh, despite the charm offensive, North Korea remains the next threat to peace. Or I saw New York Times, is North Korea causing trouble or giving peace a chance? So even when there are these outright, you know, peace negotiation offers, it's still being portrayed as some sneaky, underhanded regime tactic or something. So we'll see. We'll see how it develops. But I certainly hope this is something towards an easing of tensions.
Yeah, how about it? It is interesting. I read an article, I believe it was today, who quoted a Japanese professor of international politics. I believe this is pronounced Takushoku University in Tokyo. I think the professor's name was Takashi Kawakimi, who said, for Japan, it's a nightmare scenario. North Korea skillfully driving a wedge between U.S., Japan, and South Korea. I forget where that was reported, but it was certainly some U.S. news outlet. So interesting stuff, for sure. Anything else going on you want to talk about?
Well, on the economic front, it is interesting to note that Haruhiko Kuroda, who is the central bank governor here, the Bank of Japan governor, has just been given a second term, and apparently he's the first Japanese central bank governor to be given a second term since the 1950s.
Wow.
So that's significant, and shows that Prime Minister Abe, I guess, certainly feels Kuroda to be on his team with the Abenomics program. Huh. And interestingly enough, we were just talking a couple weeks ago about the idea that the Bank of Japan floated that they might be taking their foot off the gas pedal when it comes to stimulus and the market's freaking out. Well, it seems that the team that Kuroda is assembling for his second term points to the fact that he may be actually ready to go back into more stimulus to make sure that things keep popping along here. And they are popping along. In fact, the latest figures to come out, as far as you can trust government cooked books, but at any rate, the official figures show the eighth straight quarter of GDP increase in Japan, the first time that's happened in 28 years. So there is some sort of economic activity happening right now, but it really comes back to the question, how much of it is authentic, real economic activity, and how much of it is this Bank of Japan stimulus funny money floating around giving the junkie its heroin, and, you know, can those training wheels be taken away is still remains, I think, the central question.
Yeah, well, what do you make then of the past week and a half in the U.S. stock and bond markets? I mean, up, down, all around, the good, the bad, the ugly, crazy volatility, a falling dollar, rising interest rates, and now inflationary pressures. To you, what does all of that mean?
Well, I mean, it cannot be anything other than a giant red blinking warning signal, I think. And I would imagine that the historians of a future age, looking back at the, you know, whatever crisis we enter into, will go, well, they should have seen it coming, shouldn't they?
Mm-hmm.
I certainly think the volatility speaks volumes about the state of the underlying economic activity that has been behind this ridiculous, unbelievable stock market boom of the last 10 years, let alone the last 6 months or so, with record high after record high after record high, despite retail sales not particularly doing that well. There's not economic activity underlying this, manufacturing, anywhere you look across the board, there's nothing to justify this all-time record high levels on the stock market. Clearly, it's a stock bubble. It's also a bond bubble. It's also a property bubble. It's everything. It's an everything bubble that has been inflated by this central bank stimulus. Federal Reserve, Bank of Japan, ECB, all over the world, this money's been sloshing through the system. And it's just a fact. Gravity exists. What goes up comes down. This will happen at some point. There will be a backlash to this, and I think we're just getting the taste of it right now.
Do you foresee further problems in the global bond markets?
Certainly. I mean, again, I don't think we're out of the woods here by any means. And there is, I mean, for example, here in Japan, they're talking about the idea that they might start to actually get into inflationary territory after a couple of decades of the deflationary spiral here. And again, they're already talking about stimulus and things to keep that going. So it's just, again, it just defies economic reality. And I'll believe it when we see it, when we're out of the woods and we've inflated ourselves out of this bubble that was created, obviously, in the mid part of last decade that popped, and they kept it inflated with all this funny money. And I just don't think that's going to last.
Well, speaking of real and surreal, I noted in last week's Corbett Report newsletter featured your 2017 Fake News Awards honorable mention. As you wrote, if you don't mind me sharing some of your words, that there were plenty of media outlets that deserve recognition for their terrible reporting over the past year, in addition to the one that were officially recognized by our president. Now, your awards honor three fake news reports from last year. The first honorable mention features the ever-changing story of Jesus Campos, Vegas victim, or Vegas victim, question mark. The official story of the Vegas shooting, as you tell it, to use your own words, a phantasmagoric kaleidoscope. I love that phrase. Of changing timelines, contradictory evidence, and deliberate confusion. But all the parts of that story just don't make sense. Perhaps none is quite as bizarre as the story of Jesus. Would you like to tell listeners about Jesus and his questionable story?
Yes. Well, we were first told in the immediate aftermath of whatever happened there in Vegas, we were told that Campos had gone to Paddock's room to confront him, obviously after he had begun firing, and was shot in the leg. And he managed to hold on until help arrived and then distracted Paddock from firing on the crowd, to keeping him from firing at certain times. And then eventually, of course, they subdued Paddock. That was the story we were told.
Campos, the hero.
Exactly. Campos was a hero, the crusading hero who went in and confronted the gunman. But then by October 10th, so 9 days later, the story had completely changed. They retracted all of that, and they said, no. Campos was on the scene and was shot by Paddock. He was there to investigate. There was a locked door on the 32nd floor. He was there to investigate that. He came across Paddock's room and was confronted and shot before Paddock had begun firing on the crowd. So this wasn't the going to confront the gunman story. This was he just kind of stumbled into it and got shot. And then this raised questions about, well, then why if he had been shot before the firing had even started and he had obviously requested help, then why hadn't the police been able to find where the gunman was? They clearly knew where he was.
Oh, yeah.
So what's going on here? It didn't make any sense. There were all sorts of questions. He had, of course, many, many different interviews scheduled with Fox and other outlets. But then, after having, I believe, received some sort of award or been in some meeting, gotten some health appointment, he suddenly vanished, and no one could find him.
It turns out, apparently,
he went to Mexico for a few days or something and came back. After, of course, he had been scheduled, as I say, with a number of different outlets for interviews. And then he came back to do one and only one interview on Ellen, the Ellen DeGeneres talk show. Why on earth does he end up on Ellen, of all places? Not exactly known for its hard-hitting, you know, news interviews.
It's so bizarre.
But then, of course, it turns out Ellen does actually have business arrangements with MGM and the casino industry, and that MGM had dictated absolutely every aspect of that interview and what could and could not be asked and what would be answered. There's something clearly there. But then the weirdest part of all of this is that independent reporters have been doing reports showing that there are people on the security team at Mandalay Bay who say they have no idea who Campos was. Never saw him before. He's not part of the 20-man security detail for Mandalay Bay. So there are people who even deny that he is a security guard. So I have no idea. I don't have any definitive evidence of what did or didn't happen, but I do know that whatever story we've been fed about Campos is just fake news.
Crazy. Do we know anything more about his handler or this building engineer, supposedly, who was acting as some sort of handler, as you put it? Stephen Schuck, I believe, is his name.
Yes, Schuck, which I actually misspelled later on in the article as Schmuck, but I
well,
actually ended up
Freudian
reading that
slip.
But Stephen Schuck, yes. Again, the same reports that question whether Campos was even a security guard at Mandalay Bay question, again, who was Stephen Schuck, the supposed building engineer? Again, so there are people who claim that they'd never heard, never met, never seen, never, he wasn't listed as an employee at Mandalay Bay, so they don't know who he is or where he came from. So there are people who question even basic facts like that. And I'm not saying I don't know definitively, again, whether or not those reports can be trusted, but the fact that those questions even linger is itself, I think, reflective of the overall reporting, or should I say lack thereof, that we've been treated to with regards to Vegas.
Certainly problematic. Okay, well, your second honorable mention, James, goes to Prop or Not, a website that, as you describe it, came from nowhere in late 2016 to label a bunch of websites, including, I might add, the Corbett Report, as, hold on to your seat, listeners, as Russian-supported fake news sites. Go ahead, James, try to get out of this one as you explain the Prop or Not.
Yeah. This one was interesting. So, of course, I was blindsided by this late 2016. This new site no one's ever heard of, no one knows anything about, called Prop or Not, comes on the scene listing sites that reliably echo Russian propaganda. They come out with this list. And on that site, a list is a number of websites, including, I would say, pretty mainstream, respectable alternative media sites, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean, talking mm-hmm. about Counterpunch and sites like that, as well as, you know, kind of fringe alternative sites and sites like even the Ron Paul Institute got on that list. Yeah, clearly Russian propaganda, this American congressman who, you know, war bet. And the Corbett Report, of course, making that. And I'm somewhat proud. I guess it's a badge of honor that I got listed as a major source of material by them, not just a repeater. I'm a major source of propaganda. So there you go. At least I'm being recognized for something. But yes, this website, where did it come from? Who's behind it? No one really knows. It's still officially anonymous. And no one would have heard of it. I mean, there's no conceivable way anyone would have even noticed this website if it wasn't for the Washington Post that cited the Proper Not website in an article they did about Russian propaganda towards the end of 2016. And there was such a backlash from all sorts of people, including even Rolling Stone and other places, New York, I think New York Post, I can't remember which outlet, but a lot of outlets basically said, why is the Washington Post doing this? Is this McCarthyism? They're just basically echoing this list that came out of nowhere by sources they're not revealing that are labeling people as Russian propaganda. So the Washington Post added an editor's note to say, well, we don't actually support this website or its conclusions. We're not saying anything about that, but we're just reporting on it. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, who is this? What is it? Well, it turns out just a few weeks ago, this reporter named George Eliason published an expose where he claimed to have found in the metadata of the website the fact that this Proper Not website is related to the Interpreter Mag, which is it's now under the Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty rubric banner, which of course is U.S. government funded propaganda service that functions primarily in Eastern Europe at this point to toe the U.S. State Department line. And it's connected into the Atlantic Council and other organizations like this. So this seems to be where the Proper Not is coming from. And I don't know, I think it's fascinating story.
Well, that is more than just a tad ironic. Wow. Well, that's fascinating as all get out. I agree. You know, I always thought there was something pause-worthy about you, James. But now on to your third and last award, which goes to ABC's Brian Ross, whom you refer to as a deep state fake news stooge. James, tell us about Brian Ross, please.
Well, people will remember that story that came out at the end of last year about the meeting, apparently, that Flynn had with Russian officials. Apparently, he was directed to contact Russian officials during the Trump campaign while they were still campaigning. You know, clear sign of Russian collusion in the election.
Yes.
Except, oh yeah, a few hours later he said, oh wait, no, my sources clarified that it was actually after the election. So after President-elect Trump had directed his national security advisor to contact Russian officials, i.e. the normal... you know, and so, of course, the discrepancy between the original report and what he ended up clarifying a few hours later was just so immense they actually ended up suspending Brian Ross for it. But it wasn't the first time that he's reported fake news.
Brian Ross, bye-bye. James, thanks for those insights. Listeners, we'll be back in a few minutes after these messages.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back to Financial Survival Radio. I'm Dave Allen, here with our guest, James Corbett. Now, we're just listening to James' fake story, fake news stories of the year, honorable mention. We appreciate your insights into those fine examples of shabby reporting, James. Would you mind telling listeners where they can view that information?
Yes, well, the fake news of the year honorable mentions that we were reading from there did come from the International Forecaster, of course, always available at theinternationalforecaster.com. But that was a sort of follow-up to a podcast that I did recently, the first annual Real Fake News Awards, where, of course, we had the fake news awards that the GOP issued recently, talking about some of the fake news stories that have been issued about the Trump administration over the past year. But I wanted to do one that wasn't so partisan in nature, so I decided to give the Real Fake News Awards, and I did so on my website. You can find that under episode 329 of my podcast, where we were giving fake news awards to places like CNN for their ridiculous interview with Bana Alabed, the 8-year-old Syrian girl who was reading from a teleprompter about how please bomb our country to save us all, and things along those lines. So I suggest people check that out, because again, some of the fake news stories of 2017 were really incredibly over the top.
Thank you. The listeners, again, that's on thecorbettreport.com. Now, on to this week's Corbett Report newsletter, if you don't mind, where, James, you wrote an article titled An Open Letter to Olivia Is it Solon or Solon?
Good question. I say Solon, but something like that.
She's a so-called technology reporter for the Guardian newspaper's San Francisco branch. And with your permission, I'm going to set the table for viewers about this intriguing story. And so, in your word, here goes. This is James Corbett now, listeners. As attentive Corbett Report viewers will already know, The Guardian was the recipient of the highest dishonor of the year this year, the award for the fakest fake news story of the year 2017 at my first annual Real Fake News Awards, a.k.a. the Dinos. Specifically, the dishonor was bestowed on the Guardian San Francisco-based technology reporter just named Olivia Solon for her breathtaking contribution to the annals of establishment fake news hackery, how Syria's white helmets became victims of an online propaganda machine. James, please do tell us about Olivia and her fake news.
So, for people who haven't read that Guardian article, I would suggest they do so just to see how incredibly over the top the expose, the smear, I should say, of independent journalists has gone in the mainstream media. And this is regarding the white helmets, the so-called Syrian civil defense operating in Syria right now. And for people who don't know, this is a team, we're told it's 3,000 men and some women, basically volunteers who rush into buildings that have been bombed by the Syrian government or the Russians to rescue people from the rubble. And supposedly they're nonpartisan, non-political, don't take sides. It's just like the Red Cross or something like that. But The evidence overwhelmingly shows that is not the case. In fact, it's not even a Syrian organization per se. It was founded in Turkey by an ex-British intel officer named James Lemessurier. Again, not controversial information at all. He talks about it openly. I've quoted him in my podcast. And it is funded, this group, this White Helmets group, is funded by the U.S. and U.K. foreign governments, obviously foreign to Syrian soil, primarily, as well as a few other foreign governments that help fund this organization. And the worst part of it is they operate exclusively in terrorist-held areas of Syria, so obviously operating with the support of the terrorists at the very least. But more ominously, when you examine the actual people involved in this organization, working for this organization, posting on social media, invariably, almost, there are dozens and dozens of examples of some of these white helmets posting with actually holding ISIS flags, or posing with known terrorists, or posting up images of Osama bin Laden and other terrorists, praising them. It essentially is a group that is at the very least heavily embedded with terrorists and jihadis, who are using this cover of this humanitarian organization to effectively lobby, to be the PR campaign for foreign governments to please bomb Syria to help save the Syrians, which is essentially what they want. They want the establishment of a no-fly zone at the very least. So when you see these reports of, oh, this new chemical weapons attack, or this new atrocity has happened, almost invariably the reports source back to the White Helmets themselves. So I think we see what's going on here, and at the very least, the serious questions that surround this group. And this isn't just, you know, fringe conspiracy theorists talking about this. This is the U.S. State Department actually barred the head of the group, Riyad Saleh, from entering the United States in 2016. They wouldn't talk about the details of the case, but they did say something to the effect of, we're continually vetting and looking for, you know, threats and ties to terrorism. Well, and they're banning the head of this group as they are giving the group $23 million in aid. It's very bizarre. So The Guardian writes this piece, specifically Olivia Solon, the technology reporter in San Francisco, who, as far as I know, has never set foot in Syria and has never reported on geopolitics or war zones or anything like that before. She writes this piece basically attacking anyone who questions the White Helmets and their virtuous nature as being, drumroll please, Russian propaganda, of course, trolls, conspiracy theorist, anti-imperialist activist with support from the Russian government. So
from the Russian,
it was just such, it was such an over-the-top piece that I had to respond to it. So I did give it my fakest fake news story of the year. It won the top dishonor in my fake news awards. And as a result, I did an entire podcast episode specifically about the White Helmets and the very, very serious questions that surround them. As part of that, I did, of course, reach out to Olivia Solon, contacted her to see if she would comment on or do an interview for that podcast. Of course, I heard no reply. So I decided that I would publish.
Excuse Sorry? My interruption. A classic letter, a classic response. Your high
well,
Olivia
you.
Letter.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, so the point of my response was that Eva Bartlett, who was one of these independent researchers who had been smeared in the Guardian piece, had been given an email. She had received an email from Olivia to comment on that piece before it was published. And if you go and read the email she received, it's ridiculous. The leading questions are absolutely over the top. Asking her to respond to statements like, you attract a large online audience amplified by high-profile right-wing personalities and appearances on Russian state TV, or, you know, you believe, you think that Assad is being demonized by the U.S. as a means to drive regime change, and things like this. So I basically decided, well, okay, well, why don't I just use her email as a template? She's a serious news reporter for a mainstream publication. Why, you know, what better template could I use? So I basically just turned the tables and asked the exact same type of questions, just turning the tables on her. And strangely enough, she never replied. So I did put it out there as an open letter. So maybe she'll, you know, it'll get to her somehow or other.
That's truly amazing. You ever expect to get a response from Olivia, or maybe from The Guardian on her behalf?
Oh, I certainly don't. I imagine that they will simply ignore this for as long as they can. If it ever came to the fact that there was overwhelming attention to this and there were too many people for them to ignore, I absolutely 1,000% would expect them to say this is a this is a threat to Olivia's safety, and she's receiving all these threats and she needs security, and wow. that's the smokescreen they would hide behind. Of course, there's nothing whatsoever threatening about this. It's just an email that I sent to her asking her questions for my report, but that's the type of tricks that they play. But I think the larger point of this is, of course, I don't expect a reply. I'm not really holding my breath, as I say at the end of the article. I'm holding my breath waiting for your reply. I don't expect it. But the broader point here is not about Olivia Solon individually. It's not about The Guardian as an institution. It's about the way that the mainstream media works in trying to smear information that it doesn't want reported or doesn't want people to take seriously. This is the way it functions, and I want to show people that. I want to show them this email that was sent to Eva Bartlett and show them exactly how that would look on the other side. And I think it's pretty undeniable that, yes, of course, I understand why people wouldn't want to answer leading questions like this, because any way you ask, when did you stop beating your wife? There's no way to answer that question that doesn't paint you in a bad light. So it's exactly that situation, and I just wanted to show people, exactly how this works.
Well, folks, I've read it. It's fascinating. I encourage you to do so. James, always an illuminating and thought-provoking article on the weekly CorbettReport.com. Let's jump back overseas again to Japan, if you wouldn't mind. I read today that public debate continues in Japan on whether to amend its pacifist constitution. Nearly half of survey respondents expressed opposition to a potential constitutional revision proposed by Japan's Prime Minister Abe, who it looks wants an explicit reference to Japan's self-defense forces added to the war-renouncing Article 9. That's compared with about 40% who expressed support for the amendment. The article that I read, James, said that if such a vote is held, it'll be Japan's first-ever national plebiscite on any topic. But critics say that without addressing at least some of what they see flaws in the constitutional referendum law, the historic event could leave a bitter aftertaste. Are you aware of this? Is it big news in Japan? Is this a big national debate?
It is part of the ongoing national conversation here, really about the identity of Japan and the way it sees itself and the way it's going to move forward. Again, just to set the background for people, Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution that was set up in the immediate aftermath of World War II, really written out by the Americans and handed to the Japanese, but at any rate, Article 9 does say that it basically says that Japan shall not have an offensive military force. So that means Japan has a self-defense force. It does not have an army. It doesn't have a standing military. It has a self-defense force, which is one of the best-funded militaries on the planet. It is essentially a military in all but name, but it's just that it isn't deployed offensively and cannot be constitutionally. Now, they've bent that and stretched that in recent decades, especially with assistance, for example, to the Americans in the Iraq War. Not battlefield combat, but assistance in non combat situations and things like that, which gained quite a bit of controversy at the time. What does this mean? Can we be doing this? Should we be doing this? Because Japan has primarily seen itself as a pacifist nation for the past 60, 70 years, and that's the way a lot of people here think of it. But that is changing, and with the changing dynamics, obviously, of a growing Chinese military and all of that, for the last decade and a half, there has been a stronger and stronger movement to try to change, amend, at least sort of alter the constitution to allow more offensive military work by the Japanese government. And that took the form a couple of years ago of reinterpreting Article 9 so that now if an ally is under attack, then Japan can go to their assistance kind of thing. And so there's gradually tweaking it. But I think the ultimate plan has always been to actually amend Article 9 to allow for offensive military force. It's still hugely controversial here. Some of the public is on board, but a lot of the public is not. And now, as you say, the ultimate, you know, end point of this would be some sort of referendum or plebiscite, but it would be the first time there'd ever been a referendum on a constitutional matter, and there are people now raising questions about the process itself and how reliable it will be. So again, this is still something that's I think it's quite central really to the Japanese sense of identity, again, for a nation that's defined itself primarily as pacifist for the better part of a century now.
Yeah, that's interesting. I suppose the impetus for Abe's proposal is the tensions with North Korea, or is it beyond that?
I think it is beyond that, because again, I think this push really started in the reign of Koizumi, who was a previous prime minister here, who was at the helm in the prime minister spot for I think 5 or 6 years even, which is for a Japanese politician remarkable. They generally tend to change prime ministers every year or two here, so Abe and Koizumi have both been standouts in that regard, and they've both been on the side of trying to make Japan a more militarily offensive nation. So I think this is part of the larger view of what's happening in Asia Pacific generally. And if anything, it's sped up, and there's sort of more momentum on the let's change the constitution side because of the North Korean situation. But as I say, also because of the Chinese situation. And now with Trump in office and at least talk occasionally being floated of, well, let's let the, you know, the Asian nations take care of themselves kind of thing. Well, what does that mean for Japan, which has been under the American military umbrella? Should it start thinking of, you know, how it will provide its own defense if the American military actually ever does leave Japan? That sort of thing. So I think there's a lot of momentum on the side of getting this changed, and certainly political momentum in the Japanese parliament.
Thank you. Perfect timing, James. We thank you so much for joining us, as always. We appreciate your insights and your humor, and we'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. And listeners, thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188 for all of your precious metal needs, or look us up at dgscoins.com. I'll be back on Monday with Melody Cedarstrom for another financial survival show. Have a good weekend, everybody.